The number of students who are still attending school yet considered homeless is greater than a million across the country. The latest number nationwide is more than 1.2 million. We'll get into the details of the living situation shortly. In California, the latest number of homeless students, around 270,000. In Oregon, not quite 19,000. And Oregon's number appears to be climbing again, though not as high as it got in the worst of recession. School districts and other agencies work to make life better for homeless students and their families. Those agencies include the Maslow Project, based in Medford. Mary Farrell is the executive director of the Maslow Project and our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Mary, thanks again.
Thanks for having
joining
me.
Us.
Yeah.
What got the Maslow Project started?
Well, just a huge need. It was really one of those obvious things that when you start to work with kids and families who are experiencing so much disruption in their life, you quickly appreciate what needs to happen to really help those kids. And so that was sort of the what got me motivated to make Maslow Project happen.
You got this going pretty much right out of college, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
You giggle about this. It's like, oh my God, what have I done? Is that the...
Well, it was a long time ago. So it's, yeah, spent the last 15 years working to make things a little easier for kids who are experiencing, disruptions in their home life or homelessness, make it easier for them to stay in school.
And what are some of the reasons you usually find for why families are homeless? I mean, what usually drove them into homelessness in the first place?
One of the interesting things about working with this population so long is that there's so many differences between every kid who we've worked with over the years. So I can give you some generalities, but what's true for one kid or one family is not necessarily true for the next. So some of those reasons include kind of the obvious, like generational poverty, not having working wage jobs. There's definitely issues such as mental health that doesn't get resolved and parenting kind of issues, domestic violence, substance abuse. Those are kind of the obvious ones. But really what I've learned is that anyone is theoretically a paycheck or two away from being in the situation that these kids are. I mean, it has during the recession been as simple as family, was very stable forever, and then one or more of the parents lost their job, and all of a sudden things snowball to where they're having to move in with a friend or a relative and sleep on someone's couch, or they had to move into a hotel short term. Those are all situations that qualify for our services, and our goal is to keep kids stable throughout those different transitions that parents go through.
Which leads us to discuss some of the major points here, which is that when we talk about the students as homeless, this does not mean by any stretch that they're all sleeping outdoors or anything like that.
No. In fact, that's the first myth that I like to dispel, is that, homelessness means standing under a bridge, holding a sign. And while that's true, in fact, we had kind of a record number of unsheltered children this year who truly were sleeping outside, most of them camping, so not necessarily under a bridge, but... the reality that is that homelessness by federal law and by the definition that school districts are charged to look at includes any child who lacks a regular, fixed, or adequate nighttime residence. And that can include couch surfing. It can include, staying in hotels. It could include camping, shelters, of course, and really just living in greatly substandard housing. And what I'm saying there is a lack of running water, no electricity, kids sleeping on the floor, essentially.
When I had a chance to look a little further into the most recent federal report on numbers, and it seems like the federal reports lag the state ones by about a year. Mm-hmm. I think they're at least a school year behind. But what I'm noticing is that in the circumstances in which people are living, about 75% are doubled up. So these are families that have moved in with other families or relatives or something?
Yeah, and I'll be careful to qualify that. It's not really, two families who just choose to live together. I mean, that happens and that's completely normal and there's no disruption there. What we're talking about when we say doubled up and you're making evento is, for example, let's say you lost your housing and you were forced to take residence with a friend, a neighbor, a relative because you couldn't afford your own housing. And in that situation, we're really only looking at the guest family, not the host family. So it's easy for people to think, well, that's kind of a trumped up number, but it's really not. We're really speaking about families who didn't have any other alternative. And so they're sort of couch surfing with somebody who does have a house.
I see why you make the distinction, though. We're not counting both families as homeless. You're counting the family that is actually paying the rent as not homeless. You're counting the one that isn't as
correct.
Homeless.
Correct. And families who choose to live multiple families under one roof, and that's just the way they are, and that's completely fine. We don't count those families either. So it's due to economic hardship.
You mentioned McKinney-Vento in passing. You also mentioned federal law earlier, and that is the federal law that deals with a lot of issues involving homeless students, isn't it?
Correct. In fact, it's an act of Congress that was passed in 1988 to make sure that kids who were experiencing homelessness didn't have unnecessary barriers to their free and public education, such as, you know, lack of address, lack of transportation, lack of an adult even to go and enroll them and get them through the process. So for kids who qualify under McKinney-Vento, there's people like myself in every public school district in the United States to advocate, make sure that that kid can get into school.
So it's not a Maslow project everywhere, but it's some organization that takes the burden off the school district?
Correct. 99% of the time, it is an employee within the school district. And in fact, that's how I got started as well. We're lucky in our community to have so much support that we were able to start the Maslow project to provide far more services than what most school districts are equipped to do by themselves.
Why is it called the Maslow Project? For the folks who don't know,
that's
the,
a really
Abraham
good name.
Maslow.
Yeah, Abraham Maslow was a well-known psychologist back in the 50s, 60s. And his principle was that individuals needed a certain foundational level of basic needs, survival needs, in order to build upon. And you kind of have to picture a triangle, a pyramid, a hierarchy of needs. So with each, once your basic needs are met, then you can go on and aspire to higher level needs. So we actually had a student 8 years ago who was studying psychology 101 in school. He had just learned about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And we at that time were sort of this underground grassroots effort, didn't really have a name. And he was sitting in our lobby and observing the sort of things that were going on. And he said, you guys are kind of like that bottom level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You're dealing with kids who have basic survival needs. You're like that Maslow project, and it's stuck. So that's how we got our name.
So food, shelter, clothing is the base of that pyramid?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Safety. I mean, it's survival and safety. And we do focus a lot on that, and then we also try to get kids into those higher level places in their lives, too.
And we'll talk about the services in just a moment. I want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Mary Ferrell, who's the executive director of the Maslow Project in Medford. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange. You can take part in this conversation at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Check us out on Facebook. We snapped a picture of Mary as she got comfortable in our studio just a few moments ago. What age range do you usually serve? I mean, is there a real heart of homelessness for the student population?
You know, I wish that that was true because it'd be easier to target our services. But the reality is that the average age of the youth that we work with in Jackson County is 11 years old. So most people, when they think homeless youth, they think teenagers who've run away and are living outside. And while that does happen, the majority of our kids are split evenly between birth, 0 years old, all the way up to age 21, which is the year they can be in public high school. And we see about as many little kids as we do teenagers. And the other thing that kind of goes along with that is then the next obvious question people have is, wow, well, how do you have a homeless 3-year-old? Where are their parents? Well, we realize that homelessness affects families too. And so when we say we work with 3-year-olds, that's usually because that 3-year-old's parents are experiencing homelessness. So in that case, we work with the whole family. If kids happen to be on their own, then we also have services for them.
Based on those federal numbers, it seems like that is frequently the situation, though. It's a homeless family we're talking about.
That's the majority of the situation. Probably 85% of these kids are with their entire family experiencing homelessness.
So they're together, there's that, but the conditions they're living in. I happened to run across an interview with you from somebody else yesterday where you talked about visiting some child's outdoor camp, and it was just sort of strewn with mud.
Oh, yeah, really sad. I mean, the reality is in our county, camping isn't really favorable inside city limits, so they're not really allowed to erect tents or put tarps up even. So I have, I have actually visited family camps where we've got a mattress just laying in the mud and it's soaked in from the rain and, you know, all the kids' belongings are just sort of strewn along the ground and, you know, that's not a way to be when you're a child.
Before the McKinney-Vento Act, and I think you said 1988, mm-hmm. Was it a case where if the family couldn't show an address that the child couldn't attend school, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, in larger areas like Chicago, you know, New York, L.A., what was actually happening is that people were putting up temporary schools inside shelters. So then you have this issue of separate and not equal. And so that actually was happening a lot. And kids were being denied enrollment because they couldn't prove their address, or they didn't have immunization records, or they didn't have a parent. So that's really what prompted the McKinney-Vento Act.
So does the family have anything to prove in order to keep the child in their school? If, for example, they're attending Jefferson School in Medford, what do they have to do to be able to continue keeping the child in that school, even if their address is shifting or is not permanent at all?
They don't have to do anything but communicate with us, and then we do all the work. And so the reality is we want to remove barriers for those kids so that they can stay in one school all year. We'll arrange transportation, and then we sort of take the burden off the child, and we work with the parents to get the paperwork. And if there aren't parents in the situation, we can sort of facilitate getting records from their other school or, you know, those kinds of things. But what we want is immediate enrollment, and then we can deal with all that stuff after the fact.
So do the clients find you through the school? Is that how it works? Or do you find them in some cases? I mean, it's a bit of a mixture there.
Yeah, a bit of both. So we've done a really good job advertising to kids and families that we're here. They have an opportunity to self-disclose their situation when they enroll. It's just part of the enrollment packet. We also have an outreach team who goes around Jackson County and goes to the places where kids or families would sort of naturally be. And we reach out and let them know we're here and how we can help. And then just huge word of mouth. Most of our families and kids find us because they know someone who got help from us.
I noticed the street outreach team. That sounds like a pretty comprehensive sort of thing. You only have two people on the team, I understand.
But well, we have four, but they rotate in teams of two. And sometimes we take volunteers and interns from we have a lot of interns that we work with here at SOU. And so it's a great opportunity to sort of go and meet kids where they're at and sort of come into their world. And it's a really really important thing. It's what we call from outreach to inreach. So when we find them out in the community and we're doing outreach, what we really want to see then is they're coming in either to our resource center or in to meet with us at school, and then they're getting connected to services.
And what is the – you have a drop-in resource center, is that right?
We do. We actually are located in four public schools, so in Medford, Ashland, Phoenix Talent, and Rogue River. And then we have a centrally located resource center in Medford that has kind of comprehensive one-stop shopping. So we have somebody there who does food stamps. The little Clinica van is there offering free medical services. We have a food pantry. We have a clothes closet, laundry facility, and then just a plethora of support services.
What, though, can you or anybody else do about providing shelter, though? I mean, are you in the shelter business at all?
We're not, but we work with the shelters and we work with the housing organizations. I think last year we got 68 individuals housed by working with these people. And so we obviously do have several family shelters and one youth shelter. When that is an appropriate placement, we facilitate those referrals. And that does help some kids, but there's limited shelter bed availability around the county. And here in Ashland, especially, there's, you know, really not. We have, I think, a faith-based organization who offers up overnight shelter one night a week for families. And that's amazing. And we're so glad that that's happening because sometimes it gets really cold in the winter. But the reality is a lot of people are not comfortable in a shelter environment. I mean, for various reasons, especially children. So we really just sort of look at what's the most safe, you know, plan we can come up for you. And if you're not willing to go to shelter, or it's just not a good fit for you, or sometimes we have 18-year-olds who they're not really appropriate for, like, the gospel mission, which is mostly adults and can be a pretty mixed crowd, but they're too old to go to the youth shelter. So, for example, that would be a kid where we really would have to work to find a safe alternative, whether it's couch surfing with a friend or a relative. And when that's not an option, then we really just talk about keeping them safe. If they are going to be outside, what can we do to reduce their harm? How can we educate them so that they're looking out for predators and, you know, more dangerous things that are out there?
Is that the age that's more likely to be out there camping, the high school kids?
It really is. It's usually like the 17 to 19. And, of course, a lot of seniors are 17 to 19. So that's primarily who's camping, unless they're families and they're all camping together.
Mary Farrell again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the executive director of the Maslow Project based in Medford. We're talking about homeless students and services available for them through programs like the Maslow Project. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we go further into the discussion. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org, or check us out on Facebook, and you can see Mary from our studio from just a few moments ago. Anything about the numbers that we were talking about surprise you, or what's the trend you notice within the districts that you serve? Because it seems like there was a bit of a peak in 2011. And it's gone down since then, but then there's a bit of a rise this time around.
Yeah, and that peak is a little bit of a data skew from 2011. ODE, Oregon Department of Education, changed their method of which school districts report those numbers in 2012-13, in that school year. And so there was a dramatic drop. But what it was is it just took out the duplicated numbers. So if you had a kid who was homeless and kind of bouncing around the county, maybe was in Medford schools, Ashland schools, and then Phoenix Talent schools all within the same year, that kid was previously, prior to 2012-13, was counted on each of those three schools' counts. Now they're just counted once. And so what's surprising to me this year is that those numbers are dramatically back up, and that's removed the duplication. So this is actually the first year in my 15-year history that I've seen this dramatic of an increase. And outside of the school district numbers, just the numbers of individuals seeking our help at Maslow Project is up in the first quarter by almost 40% from last year. That's the highest increase in need that we've ever experienced since we've had our doors open.
First quarter of the fiscal year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So starting July 1. So that correlates with the first school year quarter.
Okay, so what do you suppose is going on? What are you hearing from people as they tell you why they're seeking you for services?
Yeah, I mean, we've been asking that question a lot too, and what we're finding is that this part of the population is just slower to recover from the recession. I mean, they're still struggling to find jobs. Housing is still largely unaffordable. If rent continues to stay high, that makes it harder to get into housing.
And in a lot of cases, are people still asking for first month's rent, last month's rent,
yeah,
and deposit?
Yeah, exactly. And then just the availability. I mean, I think the HUD waiting list is currently like 3 or 4 years long. So that's an issue.
3 or 4 years to get subsidized housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once you've been approved, it can be 3 or 4 years before an apartment or a house opens up.
Which is your entire time in high school.
Yeah,
four
exactly.
Years. Yeah. So
right.
So that doesn't do a lot of help for a lot mm-hmm. of families, no. Interesting, though, that the duplication you mentioned had been taken out, and yet you see a rise anyway.
Yeah, so we saw it kind of stabilize for about 2 years. It seemed roughly, kind of peaked and then dropped back down and stayed stable. And then now it's pretty severely up. From Medford, we're up, I think, 240 kids, something like that.
This latest batch of numbers I notice, both from federal reports and from individual state reports, indicate that minority students are a greater percentage of the homeless population, greater than they are a percentage in the general population. Is that something you notice through the Maslow Project as well?
Yeah, we do. We've actually noticed a lot of Hispanic families struggling. We've got these migrant camps that we've been doing outreach to and finding a lot of kids who just didn't know. I mean, part of it's just the language barrier. So getting to them and letting them know about our services and how they can connect with us has been one of our challenges. But since we've been making more pointed effort to reach out to those families and those kids, we've realized that the population is a lot greater than we originally even realized.
Let us take a call. We have Sandy in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about homeless students with Mary Farrell at the Maslow Project in Medford.
Yeah, I was going to ask how it broke down ethnically, so I think you answered that. It doesn't surprise me at all. I think the larger issue that I would like to see it tied to and for a nationwide discussion to begin about is why do we tolerate this? The concept of a three-year-old who's homeless just appalls me. I think it's linked into the same sort of forces that are driving the whole Ferguson situation right now. The perception among so many people of incredible inequality, mm-hmm. and until we've become a nation that actually believes in equality, I don't think this problem is going to go away, and I'm frankly just appalled. I guess that's all I wanted to say.
All right, thanks for that, Sandy. Appreciate that. So, Mary, the general idea about the fact that we have three-year-olds homeless,
mm-hmm.
How tough is this to process for people who are coming into work and volunteer at the Maslow Project?
Oh, it's tough, believe me. I mean, we have a hard time every day. In fact, we have employee assistance programs in place to help our people just sort of cope with the hardship of working with kids in such vulnerable situations. I mean, it's emotionally taxing, of course, but nowhere near as bad as what it must be like for that kid or that family. So try to keep perspective. A lot of our volunteers and staff are there because at least they're doing something, and that's, alleviating their sense of it is appalling and there should be something that's being done. And so it's an opportunity to to be part of that solution. The reality is, especially in Oregon, it's not considered child abuse to be homeless. So as long as a parent or family is providing, you know, basic essential, you know, that kid isn't medically at harm's way just because of their homeless situation, you know, it's not child abuse. So all we can do is really reach out and support those families the best that we can. It's not something that, you know, the state's going to get involved in necessarily.
I noticed that the levels of things you try to deal with in the Maslow Project start with stabilize, move up to engage, and then beyond that, move up to thrive. So what are some of the mm-hmm. offerings you have under the thrive heading?
Okay, so once we sort of stabilize their basic and critical essential needs, we really move them into a case management structure, which is identifying goals and creating a plan of action. So what do we need to do to support them? What do they need to do to support themselves? And out of that usually comes sort of a host of opportunities, which is our Thrive level of services. So we have cooking classes where we have people come in from like the OSU Extension and do food demonstrations out of actual ingredients in our food pantry to show kids and families how to make a meal out of the, you know, tools that are available to them. We have a harm reduction program where we're just teaching life skills to kids who, you know, the basic don't do this, do that doesn't work. We try to like intersperse that with, you know, food and while you're here eating, let's, you know, give you some life skills about reducing your harm to self. We have an art therapy program, so an art studio where kids can just come and be a kid and have fun and do some creative activities, which are also then therapeutic. We have mental health counseling that's traditional. And then we just like to do some fun things. So we have a youth advisory committee where our kids can actually participate in, you know, here's what is meaningful to me at Maslow and here's my voice and how I can influence those things. So we try to just create opportunities where they can be a kid and engage in the kind of activities that sort of build dendrites, you know, and build connections, because most of these kids have experienced some level of trauma in their lives. And so we're trying to get them out of just survival and doing things that actually promote, you know,
true living skills.
Yeah, true living skills.
By,
yeah. And building resilience and coping skills.
So I notice you've won some awards for your work. Congratulations for that. And where do you see the Maslow Project going in the years ahead?
Well, you know, we just hope to be continue to be a really stable and solid resource for our kids and families. And we also hope to be sort of a model for other communities who want to do something to help their own homeless population.
I noticed another Maslow Project in Coos Bay. Is that patterned after the Maslow Project?
It is, yeah. Yeah, we worked with them to get that started.
All right. Well, congratulations on the work. And it's tough work, I know, and it's appreciated, I'm sure, by a lot of people.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Mary Farrell is the executive director of the Maslow Project based in Medford. Do people want to help the Maslow Project? How do they do that?
You can either call us, but logging onto our website, www.maslowproject.com, like us on Facebook, you can kind of stay current with what our needs are and how you can help.
All right, Mary Farrell, thanks again.
Thank you.